Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Anna Bogutskaya.
On the show this week, it's Godzilla versus Kong and a battle for the new empire. A road trip veers into some unpredictable directions in the Sweet East. And on Film Club, Sweet East director Sean Price-Williams recommended 1972's Dynamo. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, bumper edition of housekeeping coming up, because all three of us have kind of announced some pretty cool things. I guess, David, you should go first. New issue of the magazine, and Zendaya's posting up a storm about how much she loves it.
Well, indeed. That's always nice to have people involved in the magazine actually kind of like it. Maybe, I don't know. But yeah, it's weird. I feel we have to, like, everything is so cloak and dagger until the last minute, and keeping things under wraps until the official announcement, that I think I've been on the pod about three times where you've asked and I've been like, well, I couldn't possibly comment. But yeah, it's nice to actually be able to sort of splurge and actually talk about it. So yeah. So our new issue 102, is out in the world now. It should be on in all good retailers and available through the Little White Lies web shop right now. And yeah, it's based on, inspired by the film Challengers by Luca Guadagnino, which we can't really say much about the film, but we can say that inside the issue we have a cool piece by Hafa Salas-Ross on the cinema of Luca Guadagnino, and we've got interviews with all of the cast, Josh O'Connor, Mike Face, and Zendaya. Very, very bizarre, just one of those sort of bizarre things that you'll remember when Zendaya called your mobile on a kind of rainy Monday evening. Didn't have that on my bingo card at the start of 2024. And yeah, no, it's a really fun, colorful issue which is quite reflective of the film itself, I think. And loads of cool little goodies. I won't list everything, but loads of cool little goodies in there. In fact, Anna's in there talking to Sean Price-Williams on the Sweet East, which is a nice little fun Easter egg for you. But yeah, so rush out and get it. That's it, really.
David, are you in the group chat with Zendaya now?
No. I think she's coming to London for a premiere. There's a premiere on the 10th, so her and the cast will be rolling out. They've already done one in Australia, and she was wearing a kind of tennis themed Love garment. Maybe that'll be a kind of theme of the premieres. But yeah, she'll be in London, and I believe she'll get to see a physical copy of the magazine then. So that's an exciting prospect.
Oh, that is exciting. I mean, I do love her stylist, who's kind of become a bit of a celebrity in himself. I think he's called Law Roach, but he does quite literal interpretations, like her showing up at Dune kind of basically in a sort of futuristic Freeman suit.
Yeah. I mean, it's very cool, I think. And she, she has got this fairly immaculate batting average when it comes to kind of red carpet stuff. And yeah, like her stuff seems to all be kind of couched in, like, it's very sort of like vintage modern, like, couched in quite historical, iconic looks. But she sort of brings it forward. I mean, I probably, from what I'm saying now, you realize that how little I know about high fashion, so I'm gonna stop before I start.
I'm actually quite impressed.
Oh wow,
actually,
okay.
Quite impressed with the fashion commentary. It's like, oh my god, Little White Lies turning into a fashion editorial. Well, now this is a pivot.
All,
I did not
all
expect.
Of this is kind of via osmosis through talking to Hannah, and actually, someone who I love, Simran Hans, she's started doing kind of fashion commentary on her Instagram, and it's amazing. It's one of my favorite things on there, so shout out to that.
Ooh, I'm gonna have to check that out. Yeah, I mean, I do remember feeling very disappointed when they announced that Challengers wasn't going to come to Venice, and they were going to postpone it because of the strikes. But it does, in retrospect, seem like a pretty good move, because if you're gonna have those three doing interviews and walking the red carpet, that'd be a shame if we missed out on that.
Oh, it's the most logical move, same as with the postponement of Dune 2. When you have some of the most famous young movie stars in the world what are you going to do? Put it straight to streaming? That's not going to happen. We can reserve that for Roadhouse.
Yeah, it does seem that now with the strikes over, everybody is just like very, very up for it. Like you see, like the outfits are now more like the Met Gala. Like gone are the days where people would come to any of these things in like a flattering black dress.
Well, talking about fashion and Instagram fashion commentary, one of my favorite things is an account called Opening Nights, I believe it is. And it's basically just archive Getty Images photography of exactly what you're mentioning, Layla, those house outfits that people used to wear for premieres. And it really tickles me to see how little effort and how little of a stylist controlled environment it used to be, and also how people dressed kind of with their own clothes that they bought.
I mean, you look at Gen Z now and they keep talking about like millennial fashion coming back, and I was just like, guys, no. You have no idea. We were in the trenches. People just kept putting belts on top of belts for no apparent reason.
Belts and everything, skirts on top of leggings, skirts on top of jeans. Oh my God, remember that?
This is actually reminding me of how my daughter dresses. She's 5, just for the listeners there, but yeah, she's definitely kind of like an over accessorized kind of gal. She'd have flown on a 90s red carpet, I think.
I think it's very cute when you're 5, not so much when you're like 21.
Yeah, I did once go into a lecture at university, and the lecturer actually stopped and said, "Like, why are you wearing 2 outfits?" And I was like, "Well, I can't." Yeah. But yeah, more kind of, but more things are happening in the world. I mean, Anna, a new book?
Yeah, I announced my new book that, well, the publishing schedule is always slightly weird. So it was announced a little while ago. I was writing it last year, but now there's a cover, there's pre-order links. My new book is called Feeding the Monster, and it's all about horror films and feelings and why we watch them and how they make us feel and why horror has become the dominant genre outside of superhero movies of the last decade. So that's going to be out on the 15th of August with Faber, and it's got a very chic cover. I love it. I want it on a poster. So yeah, buy that wherever you buy your books. That's not owned by billionaires, ideally. And hopefully it won't be total shit, because right now I'm in that phase where I just have decided that everything was wrong and it was a terrible idea to begin with. And why is this happening? Why am I putting myself through this again?
Ah, yes, that happens to me quite often when I open my cupboard and I'm just like, oh, I hate everything I own. It's part of the natural order of being.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, like, any interesting conclusions? Like, why do you think this era is sort of like having horror become such a kind of dominant genre?
Well, multiple reasons. But to echo something ethically non-monogamous when it comes to podcasts. I think there's an element of earnestness that horror requires that cannot be faked, that cannot be ironic. And I think it's one of the only genres that demands that of us in a very heavily ironic, post-ironic, post-post-post-ironic cultural landscape.
Well, yeah, which is funny because in a way you'd think that like with the sort of neat goodies versus baddies of the superhero realm, that the thing people would be seeking out would be like moral ambiguity and a total lack of earnestness.
I don't think earnestness and moral ambiguity are necessarily contradictory states. What I mean by earnestness is kind of the experience between the viewer and the film. You know, you can't go into something and look down on it and then expect it to work and scare you or produce any sort of visceral effect on you, which is what horror has always been about. Whether it's anxiety or fear that it creates, it is it's a physical genre in the same way that comedy, you know. Does comedy work if it doesn't make you laugh? Arguably no, but you have to be open to being amused, and you can't really fake that.
Well, I'm very excited to read it. I absolutely loved your last book, Unlikable Female Characters.
Thank you.
And yes, thank you again for your generosity with it, because you donated it to a fundraiser that I'm part of that's just launched. We've got signed copies of Anna's book. But yeah, me and Little White Lies, Sophie Monks Kaufman, as well as Hannah Flint, and the filmmakers Julia Jackman and Helen Simmons have been working away for the past 6 weeks to do a Cinema for Gaza fundraiser, which just kind of got officially announced yesterday, and now it's going to be the auction with all these incredible items is going to open up on the 2nd of April at 9 a.m. So please don't spend all of your payday money over the long weekend. Save some of it, because these items are incredible and more are coming.
What was the first one you secured?
First one we secured was Mike Lee sent us the original poster from the 1977 debut of Abigail's Party, which is just like a money can't buy item, signed by him and the cast. That was early on. That's Tilda amazing. Swinton reading you a bedtime story was very early on. Ken Loach was sending us basically everything that wasn't nailed down in his house from pretty soon. And Challenger Star came. Josh O'Connor came on board very early, and he agreed to he's going to teach you how to make a perfect breakfast over Zoom.
I mean, I don't even eat porridge, and I'm going to bid on that. What is your personal favorite item, Leda, that you would bid on if you weren't one of the organizers?
Oh, God. Well, no, I'm going to be bidding on loads of stuff. I don't think this is not allowed.
You're just not allowed to win.
Joanna Hogg, I suppose. Joanna Hogg has sent us this, like, custom neon light from The Souvenir Part 2. She's in, like, the scenes that Richard Ayoade is directing. And I think it's gorgeous as well, being like a really cool piece of film memorabilia. But I don't know, arrogance-wise, Miss Anne Berryman, who like shot was the first black photographer to shoot the cover of Vogue and has been nominated for Oscars, has agreed to take up your portrait. And like, yeah, I wouldn't mind having a kind of Vogue shoot of my very own. That would be very lovely. But yeah, some more cool stuff is coming in. Yeah, sex education star Amy Lou Wood is going to do astrology with people, which I think is incredibly cute.
Very adorable. It's an amazing endeavor what you and the rest of the team have pulled off. And there's some incredible prizes, like really, really cool people.
Yeah.
It's been really nice, actually, because you kind of worry that it's going to be a struggle. I mean, it's, you know, we're raising for medical care for people whose, you know, medical infrastructure has been devastated. And that feels kind of apolitical, but you do worry that people just don't want to kind of give this such a wide berth. But it's been lovely. Like Jenna Coleman gave us a load of stuff from Doctor Who, and she just wanted to check with Peter Capaldi, like just to make sure he was fine with like stuff that he'd signed going out there. And like immediately he gets back to us and he's just like, oh no, let me draw some stuff on the original shooting script, let me give you even more. Like Harris Dickinson just showed up with like armfuls of signed Iron Claw stuff yesterday. So yeah, people are nice. It's a lovely industry, it turns out.
I think the Doctor Who one's going to be a really big lot, because I think that there's probably a lot of Doctor Who fans going to want some very limited swag like that.
Stranger Things fans, Ghosts fans, like yeah, we've got quite a lot of niche stuff. Some cool women from horror too, like Alice Lowe who did Prevenge, and Prano Baby Bond who did Censor. Yeah, they're doing Zooms. I mean, it's just great, and it's just been very like inspiring, even though it's been a long 6 weeks to get it all together.
Bravi, it's amazing.
Well, yeah. Oh, and probably should add that Hannah Strong, our very own Hannah Strong, has got a wonderful lot in there where she's curated a kind of box of Sofia Coppola goodies. So, yeah, if you're a fan of Little White Lies, I believe she's throwing in a subscription too.
Yeah, yeah.
But we should get on to films, maybe less kind of ethically... I don't know. It does feel like a real change in tone to go from kind of all of these like labors of love into the fifth in the Godzilla and Kong franchise films. But it's Godzilla, is it Times Kong? No,
Kiss
versus
Kong.
Godzilla Kiss Kong, the new empire. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Uh, A few years after Godzilla and Kong fought against Mega Godzilla in Hong Kong, they unite together in a mysterious Hollow Earth threat and to focus on the previously untold origins of the Titans and Skull Island. So, David, I was confused. I haven't seen that many of these. I saw the Gareth Edwards one. I saw the one with Brie Larson, and that was it. I don't think this is connected to the Peter Jackson one, but then I heard that this is like the fifth in a series, so I'm very confused. Can you place this within sort of a timeline?
Yeah, I'll try. I mean, we kind of tried before the recording started and kind of flopped, but like maybe we can try again. From my knowledge, there is the Gareth Edwards one, which I thought was really good. Although I think perhaps divisive. Like, I don't think everyone loved it, but one of the things about the Gareth Edwards one was that it played with the Godzilla iconography a little bit more than the literal kind of bashing and smashing, and it works very nicely with the Japanese film that came out last year, Godzilla Minus One, which is, you know, a bit more sparing of actually kind of the presence of the monsters. But although just to add that Godzilla Minus One is not part of this little mini franchise, this is the kind of legendary film. Okay. Then we've got like Godzilla Skull Island, which was really bad, and then there was another Godzilla film, and then there was a Godzilla versus Kong, which is when Adam Wingard came on board. And I mean, Wingard's kind of an interesting guy in that he sort of started his career doing these quite sort of nifty throwback thrillers that were very couched in like 80s aesthetics and visuals and sounds as well. I mean, he's big into synths, and There's some big synths in this film, and then this is his kind of big sequel. So yeah, so Rebecca Hall is probably the main human character whose role in this is pretty much to kind of commentate on what's happening with the monsters, to sort of like let the viewer know. So I mean, she is basically kind of exposition machine, and she has this kind of young daughter who's part of a tribe who was on Skull Island protecting Kong originally and has a connection with Kong. And then you've got Dan Stevens as a kind of crazy doctor who sounds a bit like David St. Hubbins from Spinal Tap. I don't know if I can't tell if he's doing like a silly voice or that's how he sounds, but yeah, he's having fun.
He's being goofy.
He's got something that he wants to do, and he's doing it, and it's fine. And then you've got Brian Tyree Henry as a kind of slightly wacky kind of internet celebrity who deals in kind of I guess conspiracy theories, but conspiracy theories that we see end up being true because it's all about Godzilla and this sort of unseen subterranean world where the big titans battle it out and fight each other. And there are these portals between the worlds, and the monsters are kind of going up and down like lifts in a hotel. And that's where we are. I mean, it's hard to describe these films because I think they are very, very similar in that you have like, you know, you have a setup, and then you have the baddie introduced, then you have, you know, the goodie introduced, and then you have these other characters brought in, and then it all ends up with a big kind of five-way wrestling match on a major metropolis where you see things get smashed. In this case, you see Rio de Janeiro is completely leveled for our amusement. I mean, that's it really. I mean, in terms of the quality, I just very quickly say that I actually like having on the back of seeing the absolutely awful Ghostbusters Frozen Empire last week, I had much more fun with this. This was just like does what it says on the tin kind of business of like, you know, some big fights, some big monsters, some decent action. Nothing that's going to stick in the memory, but like, you know, I had a sort of decent time with it. Like the jokes, the characters were sort of just about good enough, just about memorable enough to kind of get it a pass in my book, which sounds like faint praise, but like, yeah, no, I was sort of lightly pleasantly surprised by it just because my anticipation levels were at rock bottom, unfortunately.
And Anna, for you, I mean, were you able to move past confused into enjoyment?
Well, I was in a bad mood yesterday when I went to see this. I was like, it's raining. I don't want to be here. I haven't seen a Godzilla or Kong or a Godzilla Kong movie since the original, well, not the original, the Gareth Edwards Godzilla movie. I'm not a Godzilla or a Kong girly, really. So my expectations, similar to David's, were very much in the gutter. I was looking forward to the free popcorn and that was about it. And I had a very nice time with this. It gives you everything you need from a big giant monsters movie, punching each other, slapping each other, occasional cute, slightly less large monsters appearing. And primarily, it is goofy as hell, which makes it very funny because there are scenes where Kong takes a shower, where Kong has a bum tooth, where Kong is lonely, very visibly so. Another one where Kong has some sushi. Godzilla is in the military, travels around the world. My favorite part of the film was when Godzilla takes a nap in the Colosseum, which if I could, I would. Dan Stevens is a self-described, and I quote, this is an actual piece of dialogue from Godzilla Kiss Kong, the new empire, the weirdest vet in the world. And I love a big blockbuster monster mash that does not take itself at all seriously. This is not about belonging. This is not about loneliness. This is not about the human condition. It's not about war or epidemics. And nothing profound is happening. And that's okay. Sometimes it's okay to see a giant ape and a giant lizard that glows pink and a big-ass moth fight each other.
Yeah, and we need to fight for our rights to know.
I will fight for the right for Godzilla to take a nap in the Colosseum.
But I mean, I read your review of Ghostbusters last week, David, and like, you know, Gareth Edwards is, for all that maybe his Godzilla was kind of not beloved by everyone, is somebody who makes handsome action films. You were talking in your review that they're sort of no longer having a lot of money thrown at something doesn't seem to have any effect on how good the special effects are. I mean, what did you kind of make of them in this?
Well, yeah, interesting, because that was definitely on my mind with this, because like, I think with Ghostbusters, the thing that was a sort of very much sort of watching the film and trying to sort of like analyze it aesthetically, as you do with Ghostbusters sequels, is that there was a decision made that like the effects were maybe intended to work better on like TV or for the film to be seen on a smaller screen, because yeah, like there was just stuff in that film, and I know this isn't the subject, but there was stuff in that film that was like, you know, that it was just like you couldn't believe that this would have been signed off for a major studio blockbuster. Like, such, you know, it was proper kind of like cut and paste stuff. We've got some, like, you know, some effects reels lying around completed that how can we kind of like jimmy these into this film? Whereas at the very least, I found that the effects here were definitely a little bit more spectacular. I mean, like, they were definitely trying to push the boat out, and there were some bits with like almost a sort of part of human nature when we're watching these films. I think like we have a sort of sixth sense for noticing the glitch in the matrix, you know, that when things don't look quite right. And like, you know, when I was watching Ghostbusters, that was tingling a lot, whereas when I was watching this, it was definitely like, you know, less so. I mean, there was the film's ability to kind of have you suspend disbelief was much stronger than in something like Ghostbusters. I mean, the thing that it actually reminded me of the most, which is one of my all-time fave, like, goofy blockbusters, is Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim, which is a similar type of, like, big monsters and machines fighting each other in cities. But, like, one of the things that I think that Adam Wingard has, I mean, there is a sense that he is a proper action director, and he has like spatial awareness and a sense of like, you know, thermodynamics and physics as well. And like, I think he achieves something that's like what to us might seem very basic, but actually in the world of filmmaking is super difficult, which is just making these like really over the top, stupid fight scenes feel like fluent and real. Like, as in like, Even there's a scene where the gravity is changing, and one minute they're flying, one minute they're falling, and it's actually pretty fun because it's actually sort of taking that those sort of elements on board as well, in the design and in the sort of choreography of the fight. So Marvel movies as well, I think sometimes the fight scenes, they're so choppy and, you know, they're done in close up and you can't actually see what's happening. But like, it's a small thing, but like, I think that one of the big pros of this film is like, you can actually see what's happening. You know, you can see who's hitting who and why and how, what the impact it's having. And, you know, you just don't see that in a lot of films.
Anna, do you kind of put some of that down to the fact that, you know, Adam Wingard does kind of have a horror foundation in him?
Actually, I think what David is saying is the skeleton key for this film. Not that it needs too much kind of over-explaining, but even Adam Wingard's kind of horror efforts have always been informed by action as well. He does have a great sense of space, and his films have always been very propulsive in the way that he films action, and that comes into this one as well. And there is also a seriousness that you have to have in order to make something so goofy on such a large scale. It's a film that takes the craft of that goes into creating believable giant monsters fighting each other in another level of Earth with no gravity quite seriously. And the end result is a delightful viewing experience because of that. Because if it was just a cash grab or another way to fill a slot in a release calendar, which is how some of the films that this made me think of at the start, before it actually started, they don't have that sense of craft to them. But I think both horror and action, kind of in order to deliver something great or even that at least does not disrespect its audience, you have to take it seriously and take the choreography of it as part of the craft that it takes to make a good action film. And I include in that the giant monsters subgenre.
Well, I mean, I thought that I was going to be the only one that kind of appreciated a bit of goofiness, even though I was deeply confused throughout. But yeah, well, pleasant surprise. David, you want to go first with your scores in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, you know, anticipation was probably fairly low. Probably not on Anna's level of being in a furious mood. But I love hearing those stories of the power of cinema trademark, where, you know, you've had an awful day and someone's stolen your phone and you've fallen in a puddle and you know, you've got no money, and then you go and see a goofy blockbuster, and suddenly the world seems okay, or at least you're kind of in this little kind of pocket of nirvana for like 2 hours. Then you have to go back to reality and deal with it all. Maybe that's more likely, but yeah, probably a two in anticipation, because yeah, like I hadn't been wow. I actually did think that, you know, I really enjoyed Godzilla Minus One, and I was just had in my mind that this wasn't going to be as good as that in any way. And I don't think it is, to be honest. And I'd say probably enjoyment is probably enjoyment, and in retrospect are both like, I'm going to say high threes. I wouldn't say this is quite up to a four for me, because I thought the first half of the film, where it's kind of setting it up, I was sort of quite like, I maybe wasn't convinced that this was going to sort of end the way it did. So it took a while for me to actually get on board with it and be like, okay, I get this now. I'm in with the goofiness and this is enjoyable. So it's a sort of like three borderline four for enjoyment and probably a three for retrospect. It's a, you know, love, a good fun blockbuster. Simples.
Anna, what are your scores for Godzilla Kiss Kong?
I'd say a one, just because nothing to do with the film. I was just in a bad mood. So a one for anticipation, and similarly to David, high threes for both enjoyment and in retrospect. I had a nice time. It delivered on what it promised, and it doesn't need to be anything deeper than that.
Yeah, I think I'm probably about the same. Yeah, coming in with a one, I was tired. I think first kind of act, I was probably at a two, because I was just deeply confused and quite bored with some of the setup. But you're right, once it starts kind of embracing the silly little quirks of these two monsters, like it becomes quite irresistible, and like Dan Stevens is just having such a fun time, it's quite infectious, I suppose.
Four stars for Dan Stevens.
I thought Brian Tyree Henry was good as well. They had a nice little double act going on. No?
Yeah. Also, I love podcast representation in cinema.
Yeah, Brian Tyree Henry is great. I do question some of the projects he's choosing of late. But, you know, he's a delight in everything that he did, even when he was in The Eternals and, in, you know, what was it? He invented nuclear war.
Hiroshima.
Ah, well, you know. Slightly less destruction here, but yeah, I'd like to see him in some more kind of leading man roles, to be fair. I thought after that film that he made with Jennifer Lawrence, that's what we were going to get. So slightly disheartening that he's still sort of very firmly in like sidekick part. But yeah, we should get a move on to a very different sort of film. It's The Sweet East.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Lillian, a high school senior from South Carolina, gets her first glimpse of the wider world on a class trip to Washington, D.C. Separated from her schoolmates, she embarks on a fractured fairy tale travelogue of America. So, Anna, for the magazine, you spoke to Sean Price Williams about this film. How did that go?
I did. And he was in France doing events surrounding the release of the film with his writer and film critic Nick Pinkerton. He was lovely, very, very funny. I saw this film first at its premiere in Cannes last year and then rewatched it at home, much less glamorous, in advance of the interview. And it's very much, and this is how it's being pitched, as a sort of fun, wacky Alice in Wonderland trip through the America that we rarely get to see. And it delivers on that. And I have to admit that I was not entirely in love with the film when I first watched it. Definitely not as in love with it on second watch. Sean Price Williams has mostly been a cinematographer. He has DOP'd some of the most exciting independent American features. He's a longtime collaborator of director Alex Ross Perry, who's a producer on this film as well. And he also was on camera duties for The Sweet East. It is beautiful. It's grainy and weird looking. It has sort of in it the DNA of independent 1970s cinema. There's a lot of familiar faces that pop up in this film. It's, you know, from Jacob Elordi to Ayo Debary to Jeremy Orr Harris, Simon Rex, kind of these faces pop up intermittently in little roles, but there is precious little plot that you can describe. It is what I would describe as a vibes movie, where the key character, the sort of Alice in American Wonderland, Lillian, is traveling or sort of being guided through increasingly bizarre and extreme and perverse situations through America. She doesn't particularly have a goal. She just goes with what with people that reveal themselves to her. And she's a very pretty young white girl, so obviously a lot of opportunities reveal themselves to her. And a lot of time is spent with characters that we might be familiar from the news cycle, particularly when it comes to covering post-Trump America. And I get what the film is going for. It's satire. It's trying to make fun of, as well as illustrate, a certain kind of America that maybe gets portrayed in a particular... I don't live there. I'm not American. I don't have that particular connection with it. But we all have a sense of what happens in that vast country because of how it dominates cultural conversation in the news very often. There is something that I'm not quite sure how to articulate that doesn't sit right with me about this film, particularly the ending. And I'd be very curious to hear both of your thoughts on it, because I haven't actually, having seen it twice, can tell you what it is that leaves me with a slightly bitter taste after watching The Sweet East.
Interesting. David, any thoughts, any theories on why The Sweet East had a bitter aftertaste?
Interesting, yeah. I also had a similar sort of viewing experience in that I saw it in Cannes, and then I also watched it again ahead of writing about it and doing this. And yeah, I don't know. I think the second dip definitely like unlocked more of the film for me, and not necessarily like the jokes and the dialogue and the story, but more of like the intentionality behind it and what it's trying to say or do. And I think that there is a sort of sui generis element to it where you can kind of, I think it's a very easy film to kind of impose thoughts and theories about what it's trying to do and what it's trying to say, which I think is inherently positive in a film. As you say, the character of Lillian is sort of tumbling down this rabbit hole of weird dirtbag American subcultures geographically aligned to the East Coast of America. And, you know, she's finding people like kind of neo-Nazis and like fundamentalists and arty filmmakers and punk activists. And I think maybe on the first viewing, I thought it was kind of, you know, there was a sort of satire in that it was kind of mocking these subcultures and had a sort of equal opportunities takedown of all these various, very politically diverse array of American subcultures. So it was it's sort of saying like, maybe my first reading of the film was that everything is awful, everyone is awful, we all have our own kind of weird myopic view of the world that we just subtly impose on other people. And maybe when I saw it again, I did actually, per the title, find an actual sweeter and more gentle film. And I think that, like, it maybe is asking you to take a bit of a leap in that, you know, for instance, there is a early on she encounters this character played by Simon Rex. She sort of wanders into this sort of neo-Nazi rally that's being held out in a field, and Simon Rex kind of gentlemanly wanders over to her and asks her if she's okay, and she knows where she is and whether she needs any food or drink. And he looks around and there are these kind of skinhead tattooed biker bearded type people around, and she, you know, she's at this rally, and he's sort of like a different, you know, he is not the kind of expected neo-Nazi photo fit. And she ends up kind of befriending him and kind of going away with him, and it's actually this kind of strangely, although, like, you know, occasionally he sort of spouts these abhorrent things, you know, he's a kind of lost character. There's something quite earnest and sweet about him in the end that is like, or even quite tragic, that, you know, he has this kind of incredible poetic knowledge of Edgar Allan Poe, because he is also a scholar as well. And he talks about how he's being kind of alienated within the world of scholarship because of his political views, which he tries to kind of hide. But, you know, he's also like, I think he's like a moth collector as well. And he has this deep knowledge of like moths in quite a kind of, it's just something I'm interested in way. And I think what the film is doing is couching these, you know, sometimes extreme political views as like the kind of new hobbyism. It's just something to do. You know, these people don't necessarily believe in this stuff and want to act in any kind of meaningful way. If you were to meet them, they'd be fairly charming and nice. But, you know, that everything has become this kind of perpetual hobby and more of a lifestyle choice. And actually, I think it's sort of deconstructing that even further to say, like, that people have these kind of political ideas and choose to align themselves to certain and like ideas and parties or whatever. But actually, it's just, there's something quite superficial about that. And the things that actually connect us are far more present than the things that divide us. And on the character of Lillian, as played by Talia Ryder, I think she's representing, the interesting thing is she's not someone who is like offering a commentary on these people, and she's not judging them at all. In fact, she is her own depiction of a kind of slightly, you know, detached millennial who seems completely unruffled by any kind of extremism or any kind of political thought that is sort of outside of the mainstream. She's just, there is a kind of like, I've seen everything, nothing can shock me, you know, and which is kind of the perfect encapsulation of like the age of Trump, really. And I think the ending is a kind of continuation of that, where I feel that like a lot of films in which a character kind of goes on a journey, you may get some sense at the end of a revelation or a or of a learning. And the film, I mean, it's a dark ending in many ways, but I think that the film is sort of suggesting, you know, no, she hasn't, you know, there's nothing, she's the same person. This journey hasn't really meant anything to her. This is just, it's going to continue. And like, she's back in her family, but it's the same. She's immersed in yet another little kind of subculture. So yeah, that was my kind of big read on the film. Hopefully people will see it and be able to kind of like make sense of that, but I hope that isn't too much of a deep dive.
Well, I there's something really interesting that you point out about Lillian. She was alongside, you know, I mentioned Williams also acts as his own cinematographer here. It is gorgeous to look at the way that he films the not just people, but also the spaces, the environments in which Lillian finds herself. But something you point out, the thing that has always stuck out to me about this film on both watches is the sort of blank cynicism of Lillian. And maybe cynicism is too harsh of a word. I don't think it's deliberate. I don't think it's in the character. I think Talia Ryder plays her with such a detachment that is both physical, emotional, moral, political in every sort of way. And that's what makes her interesting, because the edgelord chic of going through the dirtbag subcultures of post-Trump America, I get it. But I think the real black heart of the film is Lillian, you know, in the way that she is completely unaffected and unfazed by everything that happens around her, how she will almost instinctively, not deliberately, not in a manipulative way. I don't think she's depicted or played as or written as a manipulative character at all. But the way that she will find the little way, the little tunnel through which to wriggle into each of these quite contradictory worlds that she inhabits for a little bit and then moves on, was quite chilling. And I have a soft spot for these sort of Alice in Wonderland films where there is no real plot. It's sort of a journey that usually ends up, it's a circular journey that ends up in the same place where you started, right? And the character either changes or, in the case of Lillian, just remains completely the same, unfazed, unbothered by everything around her. And maybe the bitter aftertaste of it was because it was a little bit too familiar of a state and too familiar of a person to spend so much time with her and then see her end up exactly where she was, completely untouched by anything that she had just experienced or any of the people that she had met or the havoc that she had unconsciously caused.
I mean, I think that sort of lightly disassociated kind of move through what is often, like, you know, horrifying situations did remind me a bit of Sissy Spacek in Badlands. And I don't think it's easy to do. I was very impressed by Talia in this performance because there was never sort of a sense that she was misreading it. It's just that she herself was kind of took on this role of like detached observer, because sort of what else can you do? You sort of bristle up against these things and, you know, it sort of could flip so many of these situations into quite threatening ones. So she does feel kind of like in control of it, even though she's doing so in like this incredibly passive way. I would just say I really liked the scenes with Jeremy O'Harris and Ayo Edebiri as well. Like, that sort of, they are such sort of memeable characters, and it's not exactly that like they're doing anything subtle here, but I thought that kind of big shift in tone when she's kind of spending time with them worked really well.
I mean, one of the things also, just I guess, which we haven't really even touched on, is that, like, you know, I think this is going to be a kind of gift for, I guess, those who sort of self-describe as hardcore cinephiles will kind of see, you know, we'll be able to kind of pick out a wealth of references. And it's a real kind of fun grab bag of things, like, you know, one minute you're thinking, oh, this is Robert Bresson, and then you know, the next minute it's like, oh, this is a trauma movie, you know, like it's coming from all angles. And I think it's interesting that Sean Price Williams, I mean, you spoke to him about this in his interview, but like, he's just released this book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to
he's released a book with Metrograph for listeners who might not be New York based is an art house cinema in New York, and they've recently been expanding into, you know, publishing film criticism and releasing films and now publishing. And Sean Price Williams has published a book that he a very small one. I haven't physically held a copy, but he described it as something that could fit into your back pocket, that you would carry with you to a video store and then write in it, make notes, cross off films that you have watched, destroy it basically, which I thought was a kind of a very, you know, design-led, ingenious concept. It's the sort of anti-letterbox in a way of, I just want to carry it with me and it's specific to me, and every single book is an object that will be different based on the person who owns it. And it's inspired by this email that he used to send to people, handpicked people, where he would list 1,000 films, not the best 1,000 films, just 1,000 films that he liked. I've never received this list, but he said that he had stopped sending it a few years ago, but this kind of was born out of that.
Oh, well, that sounds absolutely wonderful. Not that people should deface books. Please don't deface Anna's books, but this one.
No, make notes in it, deface it, underline it. I underline every single one of my books. Every single one of my books is unique to me. And if you read it, you'll know exactly what drew my attention.
It is funny that, because I was always told that's like the worst thing you can do. But when my grandfather passed, I took loads of his books, and I love the bits that he's underlined and like circled and scribble little things.
I always try and buy secondhand in the hope that there's going to be scribbles on the book, on the pages. It's the best.
Same.
So, well, we should move on to the next one. But so do you want to do your scores first, David? First up, in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
Yeah, I'm going to go 4s across the board for this. I think it's almost like giving it a 5 would almost be kind of against its own nature, that it's kind of intentionally meant to be kind of scrappy and alienating and off-putting in some way. So, you know, I don't think it has that sort of pristine perfection to it. And I think that, like, you know, a lot of people, I imagine, will hate it. And I think, but very much by design. But yeah, like, definitely, like, for the second viewing for me, it kind of revealed itself as something more, and I'm actually very excited to see it again, and I'd, you know, happily watch it again, and would feel that there'd be more to learn.
Anna, what about you?
I would say 4 for anticipation. I was really excited to watch it. A high 2 for enjoyment because of everything I discussed, kind of the, and I do completely see that it is deliberate, but so I actually think that might be a positive score for the film. It achieved what it was setting out for, what it was setting out to do. And for in retretrospect, I'm going to say a 2 as well.
I think I'm kind of somewhere in between, probably 3 in anticipation, 3 in enjoyment. But yes, I appreciate that a lot of it is designed to be purposefully unpleasant, even though it's, like you said, gorgeous. But a 4 in retrospect. I'm excited to watch it a second time and kind of pick out more details of it, because it just feels like a very thoughtful piece and not what I kind of initially assumed, where this guy that had been in the industry for a while called in a lot of favors, and hence where you have this like pretty impressive cast. But yeah, he was kind enough to give us a recommendation for Film Club. So next up, it's Dynamo. Dynamo is a drama exploring the distinctions between the person's self and his projection of that self to others. It's a horror movie tragically suggesting how projection can become more substantial than the self behind it. I have to say, that is quite the summary that I was given, but that is like the technical one that is out. David, what did you make of 1972's Dynamo?
Well, I don't know if you guys got this, but Sean sent us a little note as well, which I could read out.
Oh yeah.
He said, "It's the greatest film that watches you as much as you watch it. In the opening credits of Sweet East, Talia is directly engaging with the audience, and several times throughout the film, she checks on the audience by looking directly into the camera. Dynamo is completely hypnotic. In fact, a singular experience, not just a movie. So that's his take on it. You know, I was really excited when we got this because, like, I've only ever seen one Stephen Dwoskin film, which is called Central Bazaar, because the BFI did a DVD of it a while back. And for issue 80 of Little White Lies, we did this kind of special issue on kind of British art and experimental cinema around the release of The Souvenir. And that was one of the films that I kind of caught up with and was really excited. But like, yeah, it's super hard to actually see Dwoskin's films. You usually see him at like on 16mm in a gallery or something. So it was great to kind of find to see this. And I actually ended up weirdly, just for a bit of context. And you guys will, we haven't really described the film, so you guys will probably appreciate this more than the listeners at this point. But like, I watched it in at the middle of our office on my laptop, which is not very, very much suboptimal viewing conditions for a film like this, but it was a kind of needs must sort of situation. And yeah, the film comprises four quite sort of lengthy sort of ambient slow-mo strip teases in this kind of dingy club, and you kind of start by watching this sort of strip tease happen. And then at a certain point, it flips into this into kind of ambient mode, and you get this sort of like almost sort of Brian Eno-esque music, like drone music playing on the soundtrack, and you maybe get like 10-15 minutes of like, yeah, as Sean Price Williams says, like of direct address from the striptease artist, and they're kind of, you know, they're sort of looking at you, or they're looking at the audience within the world of the film, and they're sort of spinning around, and it's absolutely kind of hypnotic. And I mean, it's a 2-hour film where you know, in terms of like incident, it's very like minimal, but it's completely like rhapsodic and engaging, and you're just sort of watching it. Well, certainly I was just really kind of captured by it, and yeah, really interesting film. And I think not only can you kind of see some of the overlap with the Sweet East and the sort of so it's kind of the way it's filmed is like, I believe that it's sort of filmed with a kind of zoom lens, so it's zoomed very kind of close into the face, but it means that when you can really see the movement of the any slight movement of the camera is like amplified however many fold the zoom is, so like there's a lot of kind of judder, and it's hard to kind of keep it. It's not a kind of smooth tracking of the face. It's like, you know, it's sort of hard, like lots of juddering, and you can feel the kind of human hands behind the camera, and you get that, you know, you get that sort of in the Sweet East and in this film. And yeah, you really get the sense of like this potentially being quite a sort of foundational film for Sean Price Williams in general, for all his kind of shooting methodology. So yeah, really fun weird film. And yeah, interesting that it's kind of described as a horror film as well. I mean, it kind of does have a kind of quite horrific dungeon CD vibe to it as well, I think, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't describe it as a horror film. I mean, I technically did, but this is the official description.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, though, because there is sort of, there is a sense of like tangible threat throughout it. And I wonder if it's because something with that camera movement that it does, there's a sort of sense of them being kind of like studied with a like disquieting level of intensity. But Anna, what did you make of it?
It should be noted that this is a very much an avant-garde film. You know, it demands a lot. It's very much an intellectual premise. But to echo what David was saying, it is going for hypnotic. It's trying to cajole you into this sense of almost self-conscious viewing of the series of stripteases, right? The women are constantly looking back at you through the camera, their faces shift and change and are go from kind of different levels of dead-eyed to distress, which makes for a definitely uncomfortable viewing. I wouldn't call it. I was reading a review of it from the time it was released from 72 that described it as an erotic masterpiece, and I found nothing erotic in this film. If anything, it's sort of like an avant-garde kink.com version of a striptease. And I'm going to say that the sound and the music play a huge part in the hypnosis that it captures you in, that it snares you in, really. I found it to be deeply uncomfortable, not horrific, quite boring in the sense that I've seen these images so many times over, and I found myself really wanting to slap the camera away from the filmmaker to stop being confronted with the gaze of these women who were looking back at me. And I'm not usually kind of a moralistic viewer, not at all, but the absolute absence of eroticism in it, while regaling in making them take their clothes off in the most uninterested, untitillating way, was kind of gross. It's a gross avant-garde film. I see the relationship with the Sweet East, and I get what it's going for intellectually. It's a gallery film. I actually think that maybe watching it on a small screen is the optimal experience, because you don't want this on a big screen in any way, shape, or form, I think. It would be too consuming and too overwhelming, I think. I have to say, I really did not love it. I found it really difficult to engage with it past this one idea that was extended throughout 2 hours. You know, the reducing of the women in it to something that was even lower than a simple object. I fundamentally kind of do not see the artfulness in that.
Do you not kind of feel, though, that it's sort of an art piece in itself, that David was watching this surrounded by colleagues in a bright room?
I do think
room.
That. And the first email where you sent us this, and when I first opened that file, it's like, oh, David sent us porn. Great for Wednesday afternoon. but no.
Well, yeah, it's worth saying that, like, yeah, there is a copy. If you kind of Google it, there's a copy out there. And the first and I kind of unwittingly clicked on it, and I think that the site on which it appears caters mainly to a sort of pornographic audience. So it, you know, I think it has been SEO'd into that into that world.
Ah, well, listeners, if you want to check out something that straddles art house and porn, do we have the
That's
does
a good
Sean have the film for you? But before we finish up, you guys are going to give us one last thing. Anna, what is your non-movie recommendation this week?
Well, it's a little bit movie related, because I was reading the Thomas Harris novel, The Silence of the Lambs, which is obviously maybe better known as the 1991 film. And I had never read it. I read it 20 years ago and completely forgot about it. But I got one of those cheap mass market paperback versions of it that I love. I love how they look and how they sort of break apart in your hands almost, and those yellowed pages. And it was so much fun. Just such a great page turner. What a banger.
Yep. Stone cold take there.
The Silence of the Lambs, the novel. Good, actually. It would make a great movie someday.
David, what about you? What's your non-movie recommendation?
I'm going to recommend a book that I've just read. It's a new book called Morris and Marilyn. By Sophie Elmhurst. Sophie is a journalist for Guardian, does like long reads, does them for, I think, New York Times, New Yorker as well. So she's got a very sort of broad CV in terms of where she does stuff for, and has now kind of moved over into kind of novels, which seems like very obvious move. And yeah, it's a story of this couple called from late 60s early 70s called Morris and Marilyn Bailey. They were both slightly awkward. They met each other, they became loved up, he was really into sailing and wanted to sail to New Zealand in a yacht that they kind of manufactured themselves. She was like, yes, let's do this. They went out on their way to New Zealand. Their boat got hit by a whale and sunk. And they were then survived in a life dinghy for 2 months out in the Pacific. They managed to kind of make it into a sort of shipping lane, but because their dinghy was so small, these huge ships were just like going past them and not stopping for them. And it's kind of like, initially it sort of starts out like the first half of the book is the account of their survival, which is kind of, you know, it's very grueling and visceral and done in this way that is really just brilliantly written and evocative. And then the second half, it kind of it sort of shifts to the sort of aftermath, and it becomes this really beautiful book about marriage, about couple, about the meaning of love, about the sort of dynamics of relationships, about what it means when someone dies who we love, and how we can kind of preserve the memories of that person. And yeah, the whole kind of survival story is this. It ends up being a kind of context for this kind of wider exploration that's very kind of moving and romantic and very kind of original as well, I think. But yeah, it's really brilliant book. Recommend.
Oh yeah, that sounds absolutely wonderful. I mean, yeah, plenty of good things to recommend. You know, after reading those and watching these films and buying an issue of the new copy and pre-ordering Anna's book and going to Cinema for Gaza and making some donations, please. Yeah, quite a packed weekend ahead for our listeners. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's Evil Does Not Exist and Monkey Man, plus a chat with its star and director, Dev Patel. On Film Club, it's Dev's Choice of a Bittersweet Life. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Anna Bogatskaya. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.